I'm getting used to security, and I'm getting used to the cops. I'm getting used to law and order when I don't know when to stop. I'm getting used to soldiers, I can see them in my sleep. I'm getting used to everything, and that gives me the creeps. They say that once we were a beacon, and we shone like a star. 200 years later, well, here we are, looking out at the world through bulletproof glass, following a gunslinger preppy with his head up his ass. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner, turning back again. We used to think we were so superior, we could tell God what to do. We thought we'd last forever, and we acted like it too. Living in a house of cards, waiting for a breeze, and I think I hear the wind blowing way up in the trees. But I got my compass, I got my flint rock spark. Nighttime is coming on, but I ain't afraid of the dark. I got my eye on the future, and it's all green and clover. So if we make it through this one, well, I'll meet you when it's over. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner, turning back again. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner, turning back again.
Next, we have three speakers from a panel held at the University of California in Berkeley titled 21st Century McCarthyism and the Rise of the Global Police State. We'll first hear from Angela Davis, an activist, scholar, and former political prisoner herself, who is a professor in the History of Consciousness program at the University of California in Santa Cruz. She's the author of many books, including Women, Race, and Class.
Thank you. I really like the way this theme, 21st century McCarthyism, which appropriately characterizes the swift intensification and reconsolidation of the right wing in the aftermath of the attack on September 11th, but also, and I think this is important, compels us to try to think about the present in historical perspective. Of course, it's always pointed out that one of the central prerequisites of Americanness is historical amnesia. Since this is Black History Month, we only have, a few more days to celebrate Black History Month, the shortest month of the year. I want to frame my presentation with the observation that this historical amnesia that we often make light of has real consequences. It renders our historical memory inaccessible precisely when we need it to shape critical analyses about the present. I mean, for example, Dr. Martin Luther King, who's been celebrated and celebrated and celebrated since January 15, and of course he's perhaps the major figure celebrated during Black History Month. But rarely have we been urged to explore his contribution to the peace movement, his pivotal stance against the war in Vietnam at a time when other prominent public figures were afraid to stand up and speak out against the war in Vietnam. And I wonder to what extent this celebration focuses also on the anti-communist and racist repression to which he was subjected. Now, of course, it's about celebrating the dream. But what are the lessons we might learn about the need for political resistance today by looking more closely at the meaning of Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy? But the example I want to dwell on somewhat this evening is W.E.B. Du Bois. Like many others, scholars, artists, union leaders, members of the Communist Party, supporters of progressive causes, Du Bois was a victim of McCarthyism. Almost 40 years have passed since his death, and as we know, his scholarly contributions have only just begun to receive the widespread acclaim they deserve, perhaps during the last 10 years or so. The Du Bois of Souls of Black Folk, the Philadelphia Negro perhaps, and certainly Black Reconstruction is fairly well known. Perhaps best known is his observation in 1900 at the London Pan-African Congress that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. Du Bois had this amazing ability to pen these wonderful, pithy aphorisms. And I want to point to one that has not circulated as widely as we might want. And this one is about his own case. In February, I think it was February 16th, 1951, he was arraigned on charges of being an agent for a foreign principal. It is a curious thing, he wrote, that today I am called upon to defend myself against criminal charges for openly advocating the one thing all people want, peace. Now, Du Bois was approaching 83 years old when he issued the statement containing these words. He had been arrested, fingerprinted, searched for weapons. He had been handcuffed. As the chairperson of this new organization that was called the Peace Information Center, this was his crime, he had taken up the project of publicizing and circulating the Stockholm Peace Appeal. This is 1951, several years after the dropping of two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And therefore, peace organizations from all over the world had come together in Stockholm and had decided to launch a major peace initiative calling for nuclear disarmament. And so Du Bois was charged with failing to register the Peace Information Center, which he chaired, as, quote, an agent of a foreign principal within the United States. The implication, of course, was that it was absolutely unpatriotic to speak out against the bomb. It was unpatriotic to call for disarmament. According to Du Bois's biographer, David Levering Lewis, around this time an enormous 83rd birthday celebration had been scheduled to take place at the Essex House. Those of you who know New York know that the Essex House is one of the most luxurious hotels in New York. As a result of his arrest, the hotel annulled the contract, and many prominent people, an array of prominent people who had initially agreed to be a part of Du Bois's birthday celebration, including Margaret Mead, yes, Margaret Mead, and Ralph Bunche, yes, Ralph Bunche. So instead of holding the birthday celebration at this deluxe hotel in Midtown Manhattan, the celebration was held at Small's Paradise, which is a restaurant in Harlem. And I could talk a little bit about the celebration, but I don't have time. So I want to move on and raise this question. How many people, upon hearing this story, which unfolded in 1951, would attribute the criminalization of peace activism during the McCarthy era as a kind of political backwardness that we have since overcome. So much so that it is quite unnecessary to hold these moments in our historical memories. After all, that time is long past. Du Bois may have been considered a traitor because he advocated nuclear disarmament. He may have been divested of his passport for eight years, but that happened a long time ago. That could not happen in the America of today. But let's fast forward to February 19, 2002, the New York Times. U.S. forces appear to have opened a new phase in the war in Afghanistan with two bombing raids over the weekend that Afghan commanders said were aimed at ending a challenge by local militia forces to fighters loyal to the eight-week interim government in Kabul. Is it considered unpatriotic today to challenge U.S. foreign policy, or perhaps even only to observe that we thought that when the U.S. troops were first sent out, they were going to fight a war against terrorism. They were supposed to be hunting Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. Now, does this war on terrorism require us to assent to this permanent military presence in Afghanistan, perhaps designed to make Afghanistan safe for the oil pipeline from Turkmenistan? Does this putative war against terrorism require us to assent to any and all military actions in Central Asia, or perhaps in Iraq or Iran, or maybe in North Korea, to name the three countries that Bush currently designates as the axis of evil? What strikes me most about the similarities between the current moment and the era we call McCarthyism is the unquestioned assumption in public discourse that it is appropriate to construct foreign policy as a strategy of overcoming fear. Evil, of course, is the most fearful thing we can imagine. Osama bin Laden was represented as the anthropomorphic face of evil, the only response to him being an all-embracing fear. And of course, it shouldn't be necessary to point out that this is in no way to render insignificant the horrible events of September 11th, the enormous loss of life, the ubiquitous agony these attacks occasion. It is only to question the political strategies of creating what is often referred to as a moral panic, strategies shared by McCarthyism and the Bush war on terrorism. During the McCarthy era, it was not only, and perhaps not even primarily, the organized right wing that was responsible for the speed with which communism came to be viewed as the face of evil, and for the purging of people suspected of being communists or suspected of working with or being friends with communists. This was the case of Du Bois. The communist pariah was discovered anywhere and everywhere, and liberals played leading roles in purging the universities, the Hollywood film industry, the labor unions, and other organizations of suspected communist or fellow travelers. And like Jennifer, I want to ask you to permit me a personal aside. Because I can remember the shadowy FBI figures following my family often on everyday outings to visit an aunt in the Bronx, for example. because my mother was friends with a number of Communist Party members. I can tell you stories about the treatment my mother received after I was fired from my position at UCLA in 1969 because of my membership in the Communist Party. And of course, this was when we had allegedly already emerged from the McCarthy era. But these are tangential stories for another time. The point of all of this is to suggest some connections that we may not have noticed between the contemporary political discourse on terrorism that has helped us to accept the war on Afghanistan as inevitable, and the older discourse against communism that justified so many wars and the domestic aggression of anti-communism. I wonder if I need to point out that racism figures in to these discourses. I should perhaps say that to point to a couple of historical figures. Henry Winston, an African-American man who served as chair of the Communist Party and who spent many years in a federal penitentiary after being convicted under the Smith Act, always emphasized the part racism played in reinforcing anti-communism. So did Claudia Jones, who came to the U.S. from the West Indies and began to work against the persecution of the Scottsboro Nine. She, of course, was convicted under the Smith Act, imprisoned, and then deported to England because she held a British passport. I mentioned racism. When we consider also the masculinist face of the war against terror and the extent to which patriarchal and sexist, heterosexist ideas have been reconsolidated during this period, we might also want to remember that homophobia played a significant role in the success of McCarthyism. Now, looking back at the popular understanding that appeared to emerge immediately and spontaneously in the aftermath of September 11th, that nothing would ever be the same. I mean, we heard this over and over again. Nothing will ever be the same. We can now interpret this as a dangerous preparation for the enormous erosion of civil liberties in the following months. The notion that nothing would ever be the same was repeatedly pronounced by government officials, it was rehearsed by the media, and it seemed to capture the popular sentiment that the country was indeed prepared for a drastic shift in the way we lead our lives, including the increased surveillance and policing represented as necessary to defeat terrorism. The California Highway Patrol, as you probably read now, is trying to get many more millions of dollars because they represent themselves as being on the front line of the struggle against terrorism. They have to guard the bridges. They have to, anyway. As has been frequently the case in U.S. history, racist assumptions were mobilized to define the enemy. And within a matter of days, the already repressive conditions experienced by immigrant communities increased astronomically. Thus, practices of racial profiling that have long been a target of anti-racist activism were more intensely deployed on Arab, Middle Eastern, South Asian, and Muslim communities. The swift passage by Congress of the USA Patriot and so-called anti-terrorism bill without any discussion whatever, without any public discussion at all, with all of its repressive provisions for deportation and detention and surveillance, has brought about a drastic curtailment of civil liberties, which will be extremely difficult to reverse. Thus, there are sinister parallels with the McCarthy era. And those of us who have been active in the anti-prison movement for the last decade or so have noticed a striking resemblance between the representation of the terrorist and the representation of the criminal. In many ways, the public was already prepared for the mobilization of nationalist emotions based on fear of a racialized enemy. This had already occurred in connection with the so-called war on crime, the emergence of a vast prison industrial complex, which not only promoted the popular ideological assumption that safety and security were a function of the imprisonment of vast numbers of people of color, but also in the process criminalized undocumented immigrants. The expansion of the INS as an apparatus of policing and imprisonment was, as we can see now, a dangerous rehearsal for the present moment. McCarthyism kindled up dangerous and aggressive nationalist emotions. This is also just such a moment when fear is mobilized on behalf of the nation, which is now a multicultural America, though still engaged in terrifying acts of exclusion. Muslims, Arabs, Middle Easterners, Central Asians, South Asians, and those who appear to fit these labels are constructed as the outsiders who occasion the shutting down of the nation. This is yet another horrifying face of racism. Racism has always been deeply linked to nationalism, whose logical conclusion is always repression and war. There are many other points, like Jennifer and Diane, that I would like to have made, but given the time restraints, I want to conclude with a passage from Paul Robeson's Here I Stand, and a few comments. And I offer these words from another victim of McCarthyism, Paul Robeson. This is Black History Month. For the lessons they may bring us today. Okay, this was, Here I Stand was published in 1958, I believe. Those who tell the world that racism in American life is merely a fading hangover from the past, this is in 1958, he was saying this, and that it is largely limited to one section of our country, cannot explain away the infamous Walter McCarran Immigration Act passed by Congress since the war. No decree of Nazi Germany was more fully racist than this law, which is, in the words of Senator Lehman, quote, based on the same discredited racial theories from which Adolf Hitler developed the infamous Nuremberg laws. And, unquote, Robeson goes on, look how our immigration quotas are allotted. From Ireland's 3 million people, 17,000 may come to our country each year. But from India, with her 400 millions, the quota is 100. And he goes on to say, usually we Negroes do not think much about immigration laws because we've been here for centuries. But in our midst, there are many from the West Indies, and their talents and vitality have been important to our communities far beyond their numbers. Under the Walter McCarran law, with all of its provisions to reduce non-Nordic immigration, the number of Negroes who can come from the Caribbean or anywhere else has been drastically cut down. So I think that this Black History Month should carry the message that if Black communities, communities of color, any progressive formations want to live up to that legacy of struggle for a new and better world, we need to oppose racial profiling no matter who is the target. We need to follow Dr. King's call for justice without recourse to bullets and bombs and stand up against the war in Afghanistan. And in the aftermath of September 11, social movements have an even greater responsibility to propose radical critiques of the government, not only to organize visible protests, but to help change the popular discourse that equates the actions of the government with the interests of the people. The patriotism that emerged as a marketable commodity in the aftermath of the attacks, allowing the U.S. flag to adorn every imaginable aspect of daily life, did not cause the fear to wane, but rather established an array of enemies to be feared as intensely as people learn to fear the possibility of another attack. While some enemies became obvious immediately, Middle Easterners, South Asians, Arabs, Muslims, other enemies, immigrant rights organizers, anti-racist and other social justice organizations are also on the agenda. This means that political reconfigurations after September 11, for example, the dangerous reluctance of congresspersons, with the single exception of Barbara Lee, to speak out against war, have resulted in a more generalized conservatism. This conservatism makes the work of radical organizations, some of which have exercised self-censorship, far more difficult. It seems to me that if we think about McCarthyism and its construction of the un-American, and as the nation as constituting the limits of identity, community, and solidarity, then our current challenge is to imagine identity, community, and solidarities that exceed this nationalism. Perhaps we should learn how to be unafraid of being foreign agents, as Du Bois was designated, if foreign means beyond the nation. Perhaps this is where we need to be to globally defend the rights of immigrants in Fortress Europe, in North America, in Australia, to speak out against sweatshops and the super exploitation of women and girls, to organize against the global prison industrial complex, and yes, to understand that capitalism is not a synonym for democracy. Thank you.
And that was Angela Davis speaking on a panel, 21st Century McCarthyism and the Rise of the Global Police State. From that same forum, we'll hear next from Professor of History at UC Berkeley, Diane Clemens.
Diane Clemens' speech is titled, For Whom the Bell Tolls, American Freedoms.
The topic which I would perhaps like to focus on more than any other is presently what we now are facing as America, which has become indeed a global power and projects its power and wealth globally, or as Henry Kissinger finally restated what used to be the old Monroe Doctrine when the United States called itself a policeman of Latin America. Finally, he let it be known that indeed the U.S. had become global and was, in 1972, he said, policeman of the world. And as policeman of the world, the United States has certainly undertaken to respond to whatever it wants to, anywhere it wants to, whenever it wants to. In this case, September 11th, we had, however, a difference. It is the first time in American history that the U.S. has been directly attacked in such a magnitude and with a center of our urban population, the focus. The phase that we are in now, having concluded that it is a partly won war, is one of expanding the war, and of course it looks now as if in the, quote, axis of evil, one of the evildoers is being singled out, perhaps Iraq, to feel the wrath of the United States in its search for terrorists abroad. The whole role of the executive, which has been expanding from the days of the Constitution until it has become something that the Founding Fathers would not even recognize, is expanding greatly with the use of this war. It's a wonderful war to make excuses for and to allow the initiation of all sorts of policies and behaviors that would not be tolerated at other times. George Bush's presidential order on November 13th of 2001 to establish military commissions is now the phase that I think we need to look at, or at least I'm going to look at this evening. I'm going to look at it as the example because it's the easiest one to focus on right now, and it's one that you will be seeing a great deal of in coming days, to see just how American freedoms are doing, American justice is holding up, and just what this may portend for the future. Certainly, the executive has undertaken to subsume many rights that belong to individuals, which have suddenly accrued to the executive branch and have lost our individual hands. Similarly, the Department of Justice has also accrued new powers that once belonged to the courts, or which we thought were left in the court to review certain types of activities. Those, too, have tended to move upward and sever themselves suspiciously from their place of origin in which they constitutionally formerly resided. The presidential order establishing military tribunals is one in which the president himself makes all of the decisions from the beginning to the end. He can try, or he will try, members of Al-Qaeda, persons who are subject to trial by military tribunal by his edict. And these include the categories of prisoners of war. They fall also into the category that is particularly touted today of unlawful combatants captured in Afghanistan and also captured elsewhere, illegal aliens in the United States, as well as legal aliens or permanent residents, provided those two categories somehow arouse the suspicion of the executive branch that they might be involved in terrorism, which is enough alone in and of itself to begin and to initiate a whole process which can terminate in detention, trial, and review of that person's trial by only the executive branch and no one else, having occurred in secret and no word of it being available. We have been assured so far that that applies only to persons who are non-U.S. citizens, as if somehow we should rest easy at night knowing it isn't us. But that is not so, for this order is written, so with a stroke of a pen and a change of a few words, it could apply nationally to almost the entire nation. The presidential order, or the executive order, violates all of the categories of those listed in terms of their rights. In all of these cases, there are indeed rights that exist for all of the categories that the executive order covers. Most of them stem from international law and also are reinforced by national law, either legislative decrees or by rulings of the Supreme Court. The president has violated, in terms of this coming forth with this order, many of the rights of Americans in establishing this category. For example, once the president makes the decision that someone is either a member of Al-Qaeda or is somehow involved in an act of terrorism or is suspected of being involved or of aiding and abetting terrorism, then that person can be seized, put in jail, and tried by military tribunal on nothing but the word of the president. This obviously, in the first instance, is without any due process and is a trial procedure with a foregone conclusion and violates all of the original ideas of American justice, but it is, in fact, what is now in place. There is also the presumption, since George Bush has assured us, that the only people tried under this procedure will be foreigners, they will not be American citizens, that foreigners do not have any rights, is what he said, and therefore we need not concern ourselves with the fact that these people are the ones who are subjected to these tribunals, and you and I presumably are not, at least at this point. However, there's a failure here to realize a number of very fundamental things, and the fact that it has not entered the consciousness of our executive branch is of grave concern to us. There is the overlooking, first of all, of due process of the Fifth Amendment, in which any person cannot lose life or liberty without due process. And due process was set aside in the whole contrivance of the system in the first instance. So we have here, in this instance, the creation of the military tribunal, which is one that was not meant at all to handle the issues which the President says it is. This war has not been declared. It has, in fact, been backed by the Congress of the U.S. The Constitution does not call for war by congressional resolution. It calls for war by declaration. So we're walking on really very infirm constitutional ground here. And indeed, the executive is the one who is on very infirm constitutional ground, particularly arguing for all the rights believed to have accrued to the executive and being used presently on behalf of the executive. It is possible there will be a further and rather wide-ranging setting aside of the due processes, bases of the American legal system, and basically the American system of freedom and its guarantees. We have, in fact, in this whole process of a system that has now eliminated and set aside due process, a military presence of the United States through the executive branch and through his attorney general that is reaching deep into the hearts of Americans. Not only are they detained and can they be detained in this system, they have become, as aliens, an entire class or group of people who, as a class or group, and that is alien, might at any moment be deemed to pose a threat and could, as a class, be gone after by the executive branch. There also, in the due process list, are the unfair investigations and prosecutions without any warning or without any warrant, without telling anyone, your home or your privacy can be invaded. Right that you presently have or think you have to consult a lawyer in privacy should you be detained by the government is no longer a right which is respected and a right which is suspended, believed to be in the interest of fighting terrorism and in the ability of the executive, therefore, to make that assertion can be and would be taken away from many of us at any moment under this formulation. We are in, I think, a period of danger because we have no reason to believe that the executive understands this. If, in fact, the executive does, we may be in greater danger because then deliberately the executive is setting aside our rights while at the same time we have pages and pages of statements assuring us that that will not happen to us, and yet it has happened to many among us. We have to conclude, I think, not only must we worry, but as the American Civil Liberties Union pointed out to the Congress of the U.S. and to the Senate, that we are fighting a war against terrorism, but there's a war being fought against us and against democracy, and that perhaps should take precedence. Thank you.
That was Diane Clements. Next, Jennifer Terry speaks of media, the state, and academia.
Bush, the son's administration, and many who support it has made the issue of speaking out in support of freedom to dissent extremely important at this time. After all, what exactly are we being asked to fight for? What kind of world do you want to live in? This is the basic question that we must ask ourselves now that the government of this country and many of its supporting institutions and constituencies appear to be unified in a mobilization for long-term, semi-secret war on an ill-defined set of enemies, also known as foreigners. Since 9/11, I found myself asking this basic question: what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a world where it's unsafe to speak out loud critically against elected officials and government agents, where it's unsafe to walk on city streets or ride in an airplane or drive on a country road or live in certain towns if your name sounds, quote, foreign, or if you appear to look, quote, un-American? A world where it would be unsafe to dissent, that is, to stand up for a friend or even a stranger who's being harassed and intimidated for, say, wearing a headscarf? Where being properly patriotic means to submit to executive orders and to clam up even if you think your nation's leaders are making big, global-scale mistakes? When in order to seem like a righteous citizen, you must allow your grief to be appropriated into a war cry? Where the question of what kind of world do you want to live in is supplanted by the intransigent and violence-inspiring question of are you for us or against us? Now, with that preamble, I want to spend the time that I have left this evening to use this particular question: what kind of world do you or we want to live in? To address in particular some issues that pertain to the power circulating between media representations of the war on terror and the state that polices what images and stories will be circulated and which will be suppressed over the mass media. How do these matters, moreover, relate to attacks on freedom of expression on college campuses? Civil libertarians are famous for saying that there's no time more urgent to defend and protect civil liberties than during war. Why? Because if one is fighting for freedom, as U.S. administrations always claim to be when waging wars, then it is of supreme importance to participate in the exercise of the definition of that freedom, and that is to exercise that freedom itself. And in so doing, to ensure that free expression and civil respect for nonviolent dissent will be a top priority of the state. Let me just highlight for you what I think are some of the key issues that have come to light in the last few months that pertain to the matter and the urgency of insisting upon free expression on college campuses. And in each of these instances, the media plays a very serious role. In response to the dismissal of a number of professors for talking about unpopular topics, that tenure arose as an institution. In 1957, the United States Supreme Court wrote the following in making their ruling in Swayze versus New Hampshire, quote, "The essentiality of freedom in the community of American universities is almost self-evident. To impose any straitjacket upon the intellectual leaders in our colleges and universities would be to imperil the future of our nation. Teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study, and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die." That was a statement in 1957. The importance of tenure reemerges as an issue not only because of certain economic interests in downsizing universities and creating pools of unprotected labor. In addition, there is the occasion of national crisis and international crisis that has been used to go after non-tenured professors and now even tenured professors. Let me give you a highlight of recent events. In early November, that is roughly a month after the bombing of Afghanistan began, there was a gray list, what I'd call a gray list, of university professors assembled by a group called the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, which was entitled Defending Civilizations, How Our Universities Are Failing America. And this is put together by a think tank that exists within the Beltway of Washington, D.C., which has been essentially founded by Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, and Senator Joseph Lieberman in 1995. They have contributed something close to $3.4 billion to colleges and universities last year, making it, quote, the largest private source of support for higher education. I take that quote from their website. In November, when they wrote this report, they documented 117 campus incidences of evidence of anti-Americanism. More than 40 professors were named, including the president of Wesleyan University, who suggested in an open letter that, quote, disparities and injustices in American society and the world can lead to hatred and violence. Another example listed in among the 117 was a Yale professor who was criticized for saying, quote, "It is from the desperate, angry, and bereaved that these suicide pilots came." There's a long list of as I said, 117 incidents that constitute what is essentially a gray list, if not yet a blacklist. The recommended solution to this problem would be to create the circumstances whereby tenure in certain instances would be revoked. and in general, in some cases, done away with in general. Okay, another incident. Shortly after the beginning of the bombing in October, a tenured professor of communication and journalism at the University of Texas at Austin named Robert Jensen was reprimanded by his university president in the pages of the Houston papers for speaking out against the war. The press has a big hand in a lot of these situations. The case of Sami Al-Arian is a very important case to consider in light of all of this. He's a tenured professor of computer science at the University of Southern Florida, a Palestinian man born in Yemen. He's been essentially fired from the university. His case is pending, but in the state of Florida, Jeb Bush, the governor, revamped the entire state board of trustees that governs the universities of Florida, and among those are many conservative members. I want to highlight the case of Sami Al-Arian just briefly for you because it is really a precedent-setting case. Whereas Robert Jensen was reprimanded in words in the pages of the Houston paper, Sami Al-Arian is being actually fired, or at least it seems so right now, according to the latest reports. What did he do? He has sponsored an Islamic student group on the campus of the University of Southern Florida. And back in the 80s, he was captured on videotape at a conference in Cleveland in which he was engaging in the rhetoric of Palestinian nationalism and used the term in Arabic, said the term death to Israel, and that has been translated and used as a smoking gun to why now, 10 years later, though he's done very little of that kind of rhetoric of late, is responsible in part for endangering the campus of the University of Southern Florida. Why is he endangering it? His mere presence causes a dangerous situation because Mike Fletcher of the Tampa Tribune, who is a journalist who several days after the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, got on the bandwagon to say it must have been an Arab that did it, and has since then targeted Al-Arian and several of his relatives as culprits for un-American activities. That's back in 1995, regardless of the fact that Timothy McVeigh was convicted and subsequently executed for the crime. The guy, Mike Fletcher, is followed up by a more recent instance of shock jock behavior. Immediately after 9/11, Bill O'Reilly of the famous O'Reilly Factor on Fox Channel, the channel that brings you 24 hours of fascism daily, whereas CNN is half the news all the time, Fox is fascism all the time. Bill O'Reilly had Sami Al-Arian on TV and essentially nailed him live by accusing him of essentially having a direct connection to 9/11. And Sami Al-Arian did not have decent legal counsel to suggest that he shouldn't have been on that show. Immediately following that was Bubba the Love Sponge. I don't know if you've heard of this man. He's a shock jock that goes normally by the name of Todd Klemm, who has an R-rated radio station in Tampa, who fomented so much hatred against Al-Arian that death threats were pouring into the university, and that's what endangers the university. It's the death threats, which are presumed to be easily dealt with by getting rid of Al-Arian from the campus. Since 9/11, the role of university administrations has been in the news as either abetting and aiding terrorism by not cracking down sufficiently on foreign student visas that have expired. And the university has been a site for the dragnet of this kind of new kind of McCarthyism that we're engaged with talking about this evening. So university administrations have been targeted for FBI investigations, and I'm afraid that universities, many of them, are caving under this pressure. In other words, turning over records without the necessary need to do so, subjecting students to a whole series of surveillance mechanisms that are based upon last names that sound Arabic and other kinds of criteria that go along with the racial profiling that the FBI is doing, despite the fact that they say they're not. One more little vignette, and then I'll finish. And that is the situation of untenured faculty, including instructors, adjuncts, and assistant professors that I've become aware of in my capacity as a co-founder of the Professors for Peace, which has a pretty active listserv that sends out about 20 messages a day, much to the consternation of all the subscribers. Since I'm a moderator of that list, many people send material for me to post who are untenured adjunct or associate professor, excuse me, assistant professors to post under my name because they do not want their name attached to what it is they're sending. The kinds of things they're sending are news reports from the Hindu Times or from the Pakistani newspaper called Dawn. For reasons that I think are fully justified, they are afraid to have their names attached to these postings, even though they are internet-accessed public newspapers from other countries around the world. It is not coincidental that many of these people are not U.S. passport holders. They're in the country on visas, work visas, to teach as professors at our universities, and we are very lucky to have them. So I'm aware of the kind of micro-politics on a daily level of how this is being internalized by people within the university. Okay, finally, what I want to talk about very briefly is why tenure is good for students as well as professors. In bullet points, let me just say, free expression and civil dissent and debate are key to the educational experience and make students think critically and independently. Much as the left has been accused of being politically correct and policing speech, that is absolutely a false accusation in most instances. We have been involved in developing educational experiences that are interested in dissent, that are interested in all kinds of dissent for the sake of learning. What else is tenure good for then? It allows more innovative courses to be offered. If you have the protection of tenure, you can teach things that are unusual and interesting and urgent. And unfortunately, what happens up to tenure is people get so damn terrified about getting tenure that they lose all their innovative abilities. So I really like to encourage the fact that after tenure, what one can actually do is come back to life. What else does tenure do? It allows for scholarship that challenges the taken-for-granted notions that need to be rethought or deconstructed. Not in every case, of course. With professionalization comes conservatism, and networks get entrenched, and styles of writing and styles of thinking get entrenched. But there is the possibility, with the freedom of academic thought protected, to challenge some of the taken-for-granted notions. What else does it do? In the classroom, it allows students to question authority and to have an active role in their own education, because they're dealing with a professor who has the protection to offer them an opportunity to become politically aware and to engender an environment in which not only is compassion and precision brought into play, regardless of one's passport, but there is a modeling of what one could imagine the unfashionable dissent to look like. Okay, finally, to return to the question, what kind of world do we want to live in? A world, I would say, that is attentive to the realignments that are happening globally and locally. That's one thing that has happened after 9/11. The realignments have been, have, from one point of view, been triumphantly granted to Bush the son and his constituencies, but I think we also ought to think about realignments on the left and in other kinds of movements for social justice. What is our opportunity here? What are we being accused of? To be quiet is to lose. And so I would say the realignment here is also one in which conversation and dissent should be engendered and allowed and worked through. The role of the university in advocating free expression and nonviolent conflict resolution here and abroad seems to be very important. And I think what we need to do is take stock of the fact that the media monopoly that presently is running most television, cable, and mainstream broadcast networks could be broken to some degree by turning our attention, where the resources are possible, to web feed news from elsewhere, including radio and television feed from other parts of the world.
You've just heard first Diane Clemens, Professor of American Diplomatic and International History in the History Department of the University of California, Berkeley, and then Jennifer Terry, Visiting Associate Professor in the Women's Studies Department of UC Berkeley. They spoke in mid-February 2002 at UC Berkeley. The event is called 21st Century McCarthyism and the Rise of the Global Police State.
And thanks to Sue Supriano for those tapes. Also thanks to Eric H. in New York City for the material used in the first hour. The music in today's program, Long Corner Turning by Jim Page, comes from a live performance at Free Radio Santa Cruz. On September 14th, George W. Bush declared a state of national emergency. Then he began issuing numerous executive orders. Executive Order 10990 allows the government to take over all modes of transportation and control of highways and seaports. Executive Order 10995 allows the government to seize and control the communication media. Executive Order number 10997 allows the government to take over all electrical power, gas, petroleum, fuels, and minerals. Executive Order 10998 allows the government to take over all food resources and farms. Executive Order 11000 allows the government to mobilize civilians into work brigades under government supervision. Executive Order 11002 designates the Postmaster General to operate a national registration of all persons. Executive Order 11004 allows the Housing and Finance Authority to relocate communities, build new housing with public funds, designate areas to be abandoned, and establish new locations for populations. Executive Order 11005 allows the government to take over railroads, inland waterways, and public storage facilities. Executive Order 11051 specifies the responsibility of the Office of Emergency Planning and gives authorization to put all executive orders into effect in times of increased international tensions and economic or financial crisis. Executive Order 11310 grants authority to the Department of Justice to enforce the plan set out in executive orders, to institute industrial support, to establish judicial and legislative liaison, to control all aliens, to operate penal and correctional institutions, and to advise and assist the President. Executive Order 11921 allows the Federal Emergency Preparedness Agency to develop plans to establish control over the mechanisms of production and distribution of energy sources, wages, salaries, credit, and the flow of money in U.S. financial institutions in any undefined national emergency. It also provides that when a state of emergency is declared by the President, Congress cannot review the action for 6 months.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guest is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.